Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 25, delivered on November 27, 2018. The title of this lecture is Cash Flow Analysis.
Tonight, Cash Flow Analysis. Before we do that, it would be nice to revisit the stock market today. As you can see, we had an up day. It wasn't spectacular, but it wasn't one that was trivial either. You have the, except for the NASDAQ, the Dow and the S&P were up. S&P was up a third of a percent. The Dow was up not quite a half a percent, but the NASDAQ was almost flat for the day. There's still a considerable amount of concern in the market, and I'm going to show you something right now that will give you an idea of why. Look at the 2-3 year gap on the yield curve. As of, this was actually not, doesn't include today. What's the spread between the two and the three? We see, what's the spread? 2 basis points, just two. Also, interestingly enough, if you look at the 3 to 5, that's 4, but if you divide that by 2, that's 2 basis points too. So you've got 2 places now where the curve is getting ready to invert. So you've got 2 different opportunities for an inversion. Is it going to happen tomorrow? No, it will probably happen within the next 2 weeks, possibly within the next week. You're getting dangerously close to the inversion, which means that you would then be looking at a recession about 6 months from now. Yeah. There's a great deal of concern now about those tariffs and the impact it's going to have on the, especially on the Christmas season. There are some who are saying that the impulses at the White House are being blocked. Well, yeah, let's do this, but let's wait until after the new year. Because if it happens right away, it's going to be a disaster for the Christmas season, which is where many companies make most of their revenue for the year. So, yes, there is concern about that. There's concern also about the level of the budget deficit. We're having staggering, the highest budget deficits in history now. On an inflation-adjusted basis, they're the worst in history now, which will tend to drive up interest rates on treasuries, which will drive up all interest rates. Plus, you have the Federal Reserve, which is dedicated to raising interest rates because of the concerns about building latent inflationary pressures. So you've got all these different forces pointing toward recessionary pressures, and that's going to cause the bond markets to start reacting. And an inversion at the short end of the yield curve is pretty noticeable stuff. That's some serious stuff there. But if you were to annualize, see this 20 to 30 year? Well, that's a spread of 10 basis points. But if you took that down to a single year from 10 years, you're talking about less than, with compounding, less than a 1 basis point spread from, say, a 20 year to a 21 year. So you're talking about the whole yield curve is just flattening itself out very seriously. So we got all the signs that we're going to get the inversion sometime in the next couple of weeks. Like I said, it might even happen in the next week. I'm not sure about that, though. There are efforts being made to try to keep it from inverting. But like I've told you before, markets have a mind of their own. You try to stop them from doing what they want, and good luck with that. So there's where we stand right now. Does that mean that it's a bear market? Not yet, really. I mean, because you're still having these up days. You're having good, some strong up days, and you're having down days. But at the same time, if you were to look here, let me show you this S&P 500 chart. And let me look at the 1 year. If you will look, you will see that we are now below the 1 year mark. In other words, the S&P 500 has shed all of the gains that it made over the last 365 days. That's not a good sign. So in other words, you have a zero return, 1 year return on the big Standard & Poor's 500 portfolio. Not a good sign right there. And I actually, interestingly, I didn't pay too much attention to the Dow on the 1 year. The Dow, yeah, the Dow is still a little above its 1 year, because right now the Dow is at 24,746. At the beginning of the year, at 365 days ago, it was at 24,231. So the Dow has not dipped below its 1 year mark. But that still means it's a 1 year. I mean, that's a pathetic return on the Dow. If you were holding the Dow, bought it 1 year ago, and you sold it today, your return would be miserable. It'd be less than a 0.5% return on the full Dow. So we have a bad market, but it's not really a bear market yet until you just see the slaughter happen. How much of a slaughter? Maybe a 25, 50% correction. That's when you know it's a bear market, but that's sort of like the same time, yeah, you know it's a bear when it's eating you. So there's that. But tonight, cash flow. And I've done most of this before. I'm going to flesh it out a little bit, and then I'm going to carry it back around into capital structure. But to start it out, you will recall that in finance, we don't care about profit. We don't care about net income, earnings. We don't care about retained earnings. Those accounting terms mean nothing in the actual functional life of a company. You can be making a profit, but if your cash flow is negative, you can't pay your bills, you're done. That's the end of it. Well, we had a profit last year, but at the same time, if you look at how much money they have to pay their bills, they don't have it. Now, for a while, a company can keep going, even if it has negative, even if it is losing money, by improving its free cash flow. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But that is a losing game. You don't want to do that for very long. Now, here is free cash flow. Now, this one is a little bit different from what I showed you before, because this is what's called leveraged free cash flow. In other words, we're taking into account the fact that companies borrow money, and so they have to pay interest payments on the money that they borrow. Now, free cash flow, it looks a lot like what I did before. It's just your revenue minus your costs minus your depreciation. Now, I will point out here that in modern financial statements, I don't know when this happened. It's just sort of like I see it now. Depreciation is not a separate line in the income statement for many companies. They just hide it here in the costs, in the first part below gross income. It's just there, but they don't point it out directly. Some companies still do, but many companies don't. So you don't need to worry about it here if that's the case. It's just here in the cost if you're looking at the income statement. However, you're going to need it later, and where you would find the actual number for depreciation and amortization would be in the statement of cash flows. It's there. Okay, now this is the one that I hadn't put in before. It's the one where a company actually has debt that it has to pay interest on. So you have minus interest expense. And then all of these times one minus the tax rate of the corporation, the marginal tax rate of the corporation. What you are actually seeing right here, this long line, the quantity revenue minus cost minus depreciation minus interest expense, all times one minus the marginal tax rate, that is actually the income statement's net income. So you can just pull this right off the company's financial statements. Some companies call it profit, some call it net income, some call it earnings. It's one of those. Okay? Now, before I go on, depreciation is not a real thing. It doesn't exist. However, it does protect your revenue from some taxes. So over here, the company has two sources of tax shield. One of those sources is the depreciation expense. And the tax shield is the depreciation expense times the marginal tax rate of the company. That's how much money the company doesn't lose to the government. If it uses depreciation, that depreciation expense times the marginal tax rate is how much money the company saves. It's called a tax shield. The other one here is the interest expense. That one is also a tax shield to the company. So interest expense times that same marginal tax rate is a tax shield. It protects income, it protects revenue from taxation because you subtract it out before you calculate your taxes. So there's an incentive for companies to depreciate. There's an incentive for companies to have interest expense because if you pay interest to your lenders, you don't have to pay that to the government, the tax on that. So those two are tax shields. Now here's where we move away from the accounting. Because in reality, there is no such thing as depreciation, so we have to add that back in. Because it wasn't a cash outflow. It didn't exist. All it did was protect some of our real money from taxes. So we add it back in, and like I said, if you don't see that line in the income statement, then just run over to the statement of cash flows, and you'll see a line, depreciation and amortization. Then we have to look at the real money the company spent, capital expenditures. How much did it actually spend on stuff that was long-term? Depreciation is only a bad way of representing the real money. So, as I've said before, if I spent $10,000 on a piece of equipment and it had a depreciable life of 4 years, I can't take $10,000 off, even though free cash flow wiped that out. All I can do is take off a part of that every year for 4 or 5 years, whatever. So we have to actually recognize that the true amount of money the company spent on something has to be hacked off. And then we also have to recognize change in net working capital. Now, net working capital, as I had said before, net working capital is your current assets minus your current liabilities. And the change in that is this year's net working capital minus last year's net working capital. Let Think about it this way. If I bring in inventory that I'd never had before, new inventory, that does not go, I can't write that off as an expense. That is not, I'm not allowed to put cost. That is a cost. So, for example, this year in my own company, I added 18 major works of art, costing me a total of close to $15,000. It cost me that money. That was real money. That's new stuff. I can't put it here. It has to go into inventory in current assets. So my current assets went up by $18,000. Well, no, $15,000 this year, about. So, I mean, that's real money out of my pocket. So that's why we have to look at how these assets, current assets, go up. The same thing is true. So, for example, if I don't pay all the bills. Last year I had $10,000 in bills and I paid $8,000 of them. This year I had $12,000 in bills and I paid $9,000 of them. So my current liabilities would have gone up by $1,000. That's free cash flow in, because it was money that I didn't pay that I put in costs. So I have to correct for that. And finally, the great big 800-pound gorilla is cash. Netflix, give you an idea. Netflix has borrowed just a staggering amount of money, just ludicrous, in the billions of dollars. Now, if we were to look at that, how much they actually borrowed, let's say it was $4 billion, or $3 billion. Okay, now, some of that they spent right away. So I would subtract that. See, that was $3 billion that came in. Free cash flow in, $3 billion. But they spent, let's say, $1 billion of it on new content. So that would be minus $1 billion there. But the rest they put in the bank, in cash. You saw it on their financials. So in other words, cash ballooned by a couple of billion dollars. And therefore, their free cash flow this year has gone up, because current assets have gone up over last year by that amount of money. So in other words, and if a company sells stock, let's say it sells $500 million in stock. Okay, that's great. So what they would do then is they would probably in that year have spent some of that money on capital expenditures. Okay, good. So in other words, that $500 million came in. That's cash going up. Then they spent, let's say, $200 million of it that year. Okay, well, that's great. That would be minus $200 million. But the rest of that goes into the bank for capital expenditures next year or beyond that. And therefore, cash would go up by that $300 million over what it was without it from last year. That's why this change in net working capital has to be in there, to capture all those flows of money in and what actually went out. That is another one, too. That's net income. Where are the dividends? Suppose a company gives, let's say, 60% of its net income in dividends. Where is that in all of this? And I actually asked that when I was in the class like this. Well, this doesn't tell us where the... actually, it is in there. Well, how? Where is it? Because when the dividends are due, that becomes a current liability to the company. We owe $1 million in dividends to our shareholders. So current liabilities goes up, saving us that $1 million from paying. But then when we pay it in cash, so that drains current assets. Trust me, you don't have to know it quite this deeply. I'm not going to hold you to this. you take 341 from me, and then we go through this in more detail, have you do a couple of companies. It begins to get clear that way. So this is the basic model. Free cash flow, ideally, is a positive number. You want free cash flow at the end of the year. You want to have positive free cash flow. More money came in than went out. Period. That's all that matters in the short run. More money came in than went out. Whatever that means about net income, well, net income is really just a tiny piece of all the monies that are flowing in and out of a company. You see all these parts down here? That's not even in the net income. So it doesn't matter. And as I told you before, I'm being quite honest with you, this year, like several years before it, I will report positive net income. And I'll pay taxes on positive net income. But my company is bleeding red badly. I'm dying. My company's dying. And a lot of it is because the free cash flow has to include all that stupid inventory that I'm building to create the body of work of a well-known artist. So here it is. I am, this first line of free cash flow, oh yeah, there you go. I'm doing great. Well, not great, but you know, I'm getting by. Got a positive net income. But you put these sons of things in there, it's a little personal here, you understand. And all of a sudden, ouch, I'm bleeding. So I would report maybe about $3,000 in net income. Like I said, not spectacular, but you know, it's there. But if you look at my free cash flow, it's going to run probably, most of it will be that inventory, probably about $12,000 negative. And so I will run a profit every year until the day I shut the doors on that company. So that gives you an idea of how important free cash flow is. So whenever you go into your companies, when you're out there in the real world, you're going to hear all this talk about net income. You remember what I've told you. Look for yourself at free cash flow. Because a lot of companies, they know damn well that if you look at free cash flow, they're not nearly as healthy as they're putting it out that they are to their employees and the market analysts and the media. Look at our great net income. Don't look over here. Look at our great net income. Don't look over here. But over here, if you look over here, they've got negative free cash flow. So it's worth it for you to have a look at free cash flow just to see what's behind the curtain after you finish talking about the accounting thing called net income. Oddly, though, here is the source of money internally to a company. It's revenue. That's its source of money. Now, once it has paid all of its bills in a timely manner, this piece right here is what we call internally generated equity. Now, there are two major parts ways that you can raise owner's money. Now remember, see that right there? That thing, that first line right there? That money belongs to the owners. That belongs to the owners. So, a company will generate free cash flow from equity. The first part is internally generated. This isn't exactly right, but think of it as net income. What's left after you pay your bills? That belongs to the shareholders. You can either give it to them as a dividend, or you can plow it back into the company. One way or the other, it belongs to the shareholders. That's one source of cash. The other source of equity is externally generated. Equity. selling stock. You can sell preferred or you can sell common, but that is owner's money. It's new owner's money. It's going to be more expensive than your existing owner's money, because if you're raising new owner's money, you're going to have to pay people to raise it for you. So you're not going to get the full impact of it. But one way or the other, this is externally generated. Now, a little side point about externally generated equity. It is difficult. It's not easy to raise. Even a large corporation can do it a lot easier than a small corporation. Special lecture on Thursday will be about how a company actually raises money, with a focus on how a small company raises stock money. It is a dangerous process, and regardless of what kind of a company it is, raising capital through selling stock is really expensive, expensive as hell. You go to a full-powered brokerage firm, they'll probably tell you to go to hell. So you're going to have to go down the line to find someone who will bring money to the table. That used to be my group. We did that. We would bring money to the table, and we were even more expensive than those high-powered Wall Street types, because we were taking insane risks in doing it. And we didn't have insurance. We didn't have the muscle power behind. Well, we did, but it wasn't legal. To make the deal go through. Okay, now, you can drive through a mountain that has a tunnel built by professional engineers and workers.
Or I can climb it?
No. You can hire the Hulk, smash, boom, 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 and use C4 and dynamite and maybe rent a fighter jet to fire a couple of air-to-surface missiles into it. Doesn't work. Trust me, I was artillery. You know, usually you just get a lot of noise and everyone says, dude, that was cool. Okay. One way or the other, if it's internally generated, it's going to come, from revenue after you pay your bills. Okay? That is up here. This line, internally generated. If it comes externally, it would end up net of buying stuff with it, it would end up here in Delta net working capital as your cash expanded, increased, okay? So these are all here in free cash flow, as is the other primary form of raising money, which is debt. You can borrow money for projects. Like Netflix. Netflix has borrowed a ton of money. Okay? Cash went up by that much. Then cash went down somewhat as they spent some of that money on capital expenditures. The remainder expands your current assets. As you saw with Netflix, I mean, their cash just skyrocketed over the last couple of years. It just keeps going up and up and up. They borrow money, they spend some of it on content, but the rest they just put in the bank. That's free cash flow. That's free cash flow. Debt, I mean, there are all kinds of flavors of debt, but we usually, in that line, when I talk about debt, I'm talking about the long-term stuff, because the short-term stuff is captured in net working capital, current liabilities. But this is the heavy-duty stuff, the giant stuff. Now, the problem here is that this is not a free choice exercise. Should I use equity? Should I use debt? Well, let's toss a coin. The problem goes back to that weighted average cost of capital curve. WACC. On the vertical axis is the weighted average cost of capital. On the horizontal axis, I will represent the percent of debt in the capital structure. And the percent of equity would be 100% minus that. So we could put that the ultimate would be a 100% leveraged firm. In other words, the corporation was nothing but debt. Total assets equal total debt. Now, if a company has 0% debt, then the weighted average cost of capital will be nothing but the cost of equity. That's all. If there's no debt, then it's just it's going to just use all equity, and it's going to pay the cost of equity. Now, remember that debt is cheaper than equity. Debt is cheaper than equity. Debt is cheaper than equity. Simply because debt is not as risky to the investors. If I lend you money, well, you have to pay me before you give anything to your shareholders. Dividends or plowback for capital gain, none of that happens until you've paid me. Yes. And the other reason, of course, is that debt is interest expense on debt is tax deductible. And if you did the same, you pay your shareholders a dividend, you pay that after you've paid your taxes. So there's no tax shield from dividends, which is one of the mysteries of why you would pay big dividends, because you pay taxes on that money, then you give it to your shareholders, they have to pay taxes on it. That's one of those things. Dividends really don't make a whole lot of sense simply because of that. So debt is going to be cheaper than equity. So as a company begins to use some debt in its capital structure, the weighted average cost of capital is going to go down. The problem, though, is that as a company borrows more and more money, it becomes riskier because it becomes more difficult for it to pay its interest expense. And if it does not pay its interest expense, what happens, madam, to a corporation if it doesn't pay its interest payments to its bondholders? The hose comes out. It's over. You don't pay me my interest expense, I simply go and put you in bankruptcy. I destroy you right there. I finish it. That's it. So the more interest expense you have, the riskier your company gets, because that's a fixed amount. Your revenue is going up and down and up and down. You still have to pay your fixed interest expense. That's why variable costs create no extra risk for a company. Fixed costs create lots of extra risk for a company, because variable costs go like that with your revenues. Fixed costs go like that. They don't go anywhere, so smack. If your revenues go down enough, you're out of business. This, by the way, interestingly enough, is why a lot of companies outsource. Because then their costs of labor and their capital costs become variable costs. Well, we ordered this much this year, ordered that much. Your expenses go up and down with your revenue projections. But if you have fixed salaried workers and fixed factories here in the United States, well, then you've got fixed costs that could kill you if your revenues drop. That's one of the most powerful reasons for companies outsourcing. So that means, is outsourcing inevitable as a risk management procedure? Actually, no. We could actually shape corporate tax law in such a way to mitigate some of the effects of the fixed nature of the risk of fixed costs. If we were to allow for companies to take more tax deduction if their revenues dip down against fixed costs and charge them higher taxes when the revenues went up against their fixed costs, that would be a way to keep companies from running away from that risk of fixed costs by outsourcing to China. It's complicated, but it could be done. But as it is now, companies outsource so that they don't have fixed costs stuck on them, because the fixed costs will kill you if your revenues dip too much. So in other words, in terms of the weighted average cost of capital curve, there's going to be a point where the lenders are going to say, you're scaring us. We're going to have to charge you more in interest because you have a higher likelihood of defaulting. And so it can actually get to the point where if you're a 100% leveraged corporation, you can have staggering weighted average cost of capital because you're borrowing money at such ridiculously high rates. And, oh, well, we went to the Russians and they didn't charge us that much, even though we were so heavily leveraged. They get theirs in other ways. Just because you've got someone who says, oh, you're already 80% leveraged, we'll lend you money at a reasonable rate. Watch out, because they're just going to get it from you in another way. That's just the reality of it, somehow. Okay, so let's talk about Netflix. What is going on with Netflix? Because it is now 65% debt and 35% equity. Does that mean that they are now at their optimal capital structure? The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital.
One more time.
The optimal capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that minimizes the weighted average cost of capital. So on this curve right here, I have marked the place where the WACC curve bottoms out. Optimal capital structure. Before I go more with Netflix, though, understand that this is not a static curve for a corporation. The bad part is, sir, you are a successful businessman. You had debt of, let's say, 60%, equity of 40%, but you've been making money. I mean, you're making good money. You're selling a great product that people buy. You can pay all your bills. Hell, you just added a couple of buildings to your facility. That means that what's happening is that your company is pulling this way. Because the equity, think of it like retained earnings, is going up. Your total assets are going up against your total liabilities. So in other words, just by virtue of being successful, profitable, positive cash flow, you're actually throwing yourself off your optimal capital point because you're becoming more equity, less debt. And the only thing you can do to solve that is to borrow money to get back to your optimal capital structure or to reevaluate and see if you've got a new optimal capital structure. But this is literally success of a company can drive the company away from its optimal capital structure. And we see that, actually. One of the things that we always are concerned about is, yeah, they're doing great. Yeah, they're paying off their debts. They're not borrowing more money. They're putting money in the bank. Their retained earnings are shooting up against their liabilities. Total stockholders' equity is going up against total liabilities. Wonderful, but that means that they're probably off their optimal capital structure now.
So they should just get more debt.
They should borrow. Now, yeah, go ahead.
So they should borrow even if they don't need it.
And there's the weird thing. I've actually seen prospectuses, in other words, the selling documents for securities, where they said, we don't need this money. We've just got to get back to our optimal capital structure. I've seen companies that had borrowed too much and they sold stock. Well, you know, we don't really need this, but we're 80% debt and 20% equity now, and so we're way up here. We've just got to sell stock so we can get back down to here. And then the opposite. Companies that borrowed money simply because they had become too equity laden based upon their optimal capital structure. Now the question goes back now to Netflix. It has borrowed huge amounts of money over the past couple of years. Does that mean that they were way back to the left on their weighted average cost of capital curve, and now they're trying to track forward to get themselves back to their optimal capital structure? They're now 65% debt, 35% equity. The question would boil down to something like this. Okay, in order for that to be their logic, the only business rationale that would be sound, they would have to have been making enormous amounts of money at the bottom line. In other words, they would have to have been making so much internally generated equity that they had thrown themselves way to the left, and now they're borrowing money to move themselves back to the center, back to the bottoming out point. I don't see it. I just don't see it. They've been making good money, they've been making money, but good Lord, the way they're borrowing money, they were more likely something like this as far as debt goes and equity. I mean, if they're even close to being a normal company, their optimal was back here borrowing all this money, especially considering that this last issue was junk. Well, it wasn't really junk, but some investment analysts are calling it junk. They're paying rather steep interest rates for this last $1.2 billion they borrowed.
Walmart, the other best company in the world, and Apple. And all of those companies with infinite amount of funds that don't need to borrow to keep up, but just do that, apparently.
Well, there you go. And so, yeah.
They have to constantly create these cool following shows, which cost a lot of money.
Incredible, and they're risky. Some of them win, but a lot of them lose. Fortunately, right now, there's a Netflix fan club. Oh, they got a new series. Everyone's going to watch it. Will that stay the case? The other thing is, there's a buffalo herd effect. Back in the day, long, long time ago, before any of us were around, the way hunters would get food for a season is they would drive buffalo off a cliff, large herds. Sometimes the best way to destroy a competitor is to let the competitor destroy himself. You create a fire and drive the competitor away from the fire and over the cliff. It's very possible that that could be a strategy.
Yeah, Amazon's just waiting.
And we have no antitrust laws. But now I need to make it clear that optimal capital structure is not something that is abstract. Companies do this in everyday thinking, in everyday financing. And in order to do this, I need to make this real for you. So, the beginning of this is that I'm going to have two bankers. One is a stockbroker. That would be you. You help a company raise money by selling stock. You are a banker. You help a company raise money by debt. Now, we got to fund you so that you can do the deal here. Now, if my volunteers would please come down, we'll go outside. Now, my volunteers, please come down.
I said, come down.
No, you're fine. You guys are fine. And here's a dollar for each of you. Okay. Where was my other volunteer? Where did my other volunteer go? I had someone who said yes. Okay. Are you game?
For what? What am I game?
You come out here.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't wear a horse head.
Oh, rad. Okay.
Okay. Come on out here in the hall. No, we can do it right here. If you're on a borderline grade, absolutely. You're a horse and I'm a horse. You, madam, are a farmer. An old farmer. We hook.
I don't want to hurt.
Here, you want to do it? Go ahead. Okay, and you are the owner of us, the two horses.
Okay,
so I want you to lead us in. Now, first, you walk in. Okay?
Okay.
No, you got to wear the beard up here.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce to you a farmer who wants to buy two horses. There's a seller who owns two horses out there who wants a dollar for the two horses. Okay? So, you're going to lead us in. No. Follow her.
I mean, you're up short on that.
Now, the farmer needs the capital to do this. She wants $1. Now, we have two people over there who have a dollar. So, farmer, if you'll come with me. You can choose debt or you can choose equity. Now, I've got to point something out here. The fuck? This company's optimal capital structure is, do you know how hard it is to write like this? 25% debt and 75% equity. The farmer needs $1. I almost hurt something. Which are you going to choose? You got a dollar. One of them's offering you a dollar right now. Equity, offer her the dollar. Nah, don't know. You can't do that.
Okay.
Do you know why?
It's
all, she would be providing you with pure equity, which would throw you off your optimal capital structure curve. So in order to do this right, what do you have to do? How much do you get from equity?
A dollar?
That would make your whole expenditure equity, which would throw you off your optimal capital structure curve. How much do you need to get from her to hold and from him to hold your optimal capital structure? You would have to get 75 cents from the equity and 25 cents from the debt. Then you would stay exactly on your optimal capital structure point. So go ahead. What did you get?
I got four quarters.
Four quarters. You got 75 cents from the equity. I'm almost blacking out here, folks. And so now pay the horse seller.
What?
Oh. Pay the horse seller right there. Did you pay her?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So now we belong to you. And because she used 25% debt and 75% equity, the capital expenditure maintains the optimal capital structure of the farmer's company. There's only one last thing. Where the hell are you? Where'd my seller go?
Over here.
Ah! Let me have one of those quarters.
Just one.
Clearly, this is how companies have to finance their operations. If they've got $1 million that they have to spend,
They are not going to just grab it from equity or grab it from debt. They have to get the exact right amounts from each source. Otherwise, they throw off their optimal capital, they throw the weighted average capital curve off. There's only one last question that has to be asked here, and it's important. Why was it that he got 75 cents and I got only 25 cents? Can you tell me why? Because I am a quarter horse.
What does that even mean?
That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.